What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Venezuela has detained two opposition leaders following an election that it claimed cleared the way to create a constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution. The Supreme Court deemed Leopoldo Lopez and Antonio Ledezma as flight risks, saying they violated terms of their house arrests.
Leopoldo López voluntariamente se entregó.
But Juan Carlos Gutierrez, lawyer of López, said his client voluntarily surrendered to authorities and said he would never flee. Condemnation of the arrests have been widespread. Ravina Shamdasani is a UN Human Rights Office spokesperson.
The High Commissioner is calling on Venezuelan authorities to ensure that all those who have been detained for the exercise of their human rights to peaceful assembly, to the freedom of expression, to the freedom of association, to be promptly released.
The White House called the arrests unjust, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson describing them as alarming. U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert called for their release.
Their arrest comes 2 days after the Maduro regime's illegitimate election for a constitutional assembly, which provoked even more violence in that country on the streets, with more than 10 people killed in that alone.
The U.S. imposed targeted sanctions Monday against Mr. Maduro. In Kenya, protesters took to the streets Tuesday demanding an immediate investigation into the killing of an election official, Christopher Masondo. Rights activist John Githongo took part in Tuesday's protest.
In Kenya, we have a grim tradition of senior public officials dying, disappearing, but generally being murdered. And that is destabilizing. And seeing how close elections are, it's concerning.
President Uhuru Kenyatta, facing re-election in a week, took to social media to proclaim his shock and sadness. This is VOA News. More violence in Afghanistan. A suicide attack on a Shia mosque in the western city of Herat killed at least 29 people and wounded dozens. City police spokesman Abdul Ahad Wazizada said there were two attackers. They began shooting before detonating explosives. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Last month, the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan said in the first 6 months of this year, a record number of civilians, more than 1,600, had been killed. Secretary of State Tillerson promised a policy of peaceful pressure on North Korea in light of its advancements in nuclear and missile technology.
To have them develop a willingness to sit and talk with us and others, but with an understanding that a condition of those talks is there is no future where North Korea holds nuclear weapons or the ability to deliver those nuclear weapons to anyone in the region, much less to the homeland.
Tillerson said the U.S. does not seek regime change or an accelerated reunification of the peninsula, but said Pyongyang presents an unacceptable threat to the U.S. and Washington must respond. Secretary Tillerson also acknowledged Tuesday that U.S.-Russia ties remain under considerable stress. He cautioned they could get worse. His comments came as President Donald Trump prepared to sign into law tough new sanctions over Russia's involvement in Ukraine and alleged meddling in last year's election. Russia retaliated by ordering hundreds of American diplomats out of the country. Tillerson expressed hope progress might be made on de-escalation of the conflict in Ukraine. Authorities in Madagascar say at least 34 people died when a bus carrying Christian worshippers plunged down a deep ravine some 70 kilometers north of the capital, Antananarivo. The bus caught fire as it fell some 20 meters. Back in January, nearly 50 people died when a truck loaded with passengers, including a wedding party, crashed. A prisoner exchange between Syrian jihadists and Lebanon's Hezbollah appears to have cleared the way for the final mass relocation of thousands of Nusra Front fighters and their families from the border region back into rebel-held Syrian territory. It's part of a ceasefire agreement worked out between the two sides to end fighting in Lebanon's mountainous Jerud Arsal region, where the militant refugees have been hiding. The transfer was supposed to have occurred Monday. U.S. stocks continue to rally, with the benchmark Dow Jones Index taking aim at 22,000 points. Amid strong second-quarter corporate earnings reports, U.S. factory output expanded in July, but at a slower pace than in June. Still, it represents 11 months of growth. At the same time, consumer spending, about 70% of the economy, slowed in June. July saw the biggest decline in auto sales so far this year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC's main opposition prepares to launch a series of civil disobedient actions this month to demand elections.
Starting this OCAP 8 and the OCAP 9, we have 2 days goes down all over the country. People have to stay at home. Who tell Mr. Kabila that we totally disagree with him and we want him to leave power?
Martin Fayulu is a member of the main opposition coalition known as the Rassemblement. Protesters demand justice in the killing of a Kenyan elections official, commission official. A new Human Rights Watch report renews calls for sanctions and arms embargo on top leaders of the South Sudan government and rebels, but the government dismisses the report as misguided.
By looking at the nature of the cut and faced reports, one would actually wonder as to what the Human Rights Watch is actually looking for. Is it looking for a solution to the problem, or is trying to aggravate the problem?
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Burundi opens Diaspora Week with an offer of no taxes for any diaspora member who chooses to invest in Burundi. And a local Senegalese company trains young coders. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A member of the main opposition in the Democratic Republic of Congo says the group is planning a series of civil disobedience actions this month to force the Elections Commission to announce a timetable for elections to be held this year. Martin Fayulu of the main opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, says beginning August 8, the group will call for a stay-at-home protest or ghost towns in all major cities of the country. A December 31, 2016 agreement calls for elections in DRC by the end of this year, but the Elections Commission said last month that the vote may not be possible because of violence in the east of the country. This comes as security forces this week arrested members of a pro-democracy group known as Lucha. Fayulu says the Rassemblement demands the immediate release of all Lucha protesters.
We are saying that Kabila and his team, they are not respecting the human rights. The Constitution of Congo stated clearly that anybody who wants to protest, to demonstrate, has the right to do so. And the young guys from La Lucha, they wrote and they told everybody that on July 31st, they should protest. They want to request from the Electoral Commission that they have to call for the election. But what's happened? Arresting young guys, arresting them, a thing that is not normal. We protest against that, and we want these guys to be released immediately.
So the Rassemblement, are you part of the protest, or do you support the protest by Lucha?
The protest was a program of La Lucha, and we fully supported that action. The Rassemblement fully supported, and we support all actions from any organization which call for a change in DRC. The Rassemblement will support any action aiming at sending Mr. Kabila away.
You call for the immediate release of those arrested, but I thought it's illegal to hold rallies in DRC. So can we say that the Lucha protesters violated the law?
It's not illegal because nobody has changed the constitution. The constitution is clear. If you want to demonstrate in the public place, you just have to send a notice to the authority, what the La Lucha guys did.
These protests are about the elections. The Elections Commission chair has already said that elections cannot be possible this year because of violence in the Kasai region.
No, I think sometimes he doesn't know what he's saying because he's the one who said that the election should take place before December 31st. This is the presidential, the national legislative, and the provincial legislative. We told him that no way, let us make it 2. We can't follow Mr. Kabila and Mr. Nanga in their program of postponing the election because as everybody knows, that Mr. Kabila doesn't want to leave in the power. The Kasai issue is something that they have put together themselves in order to postpone the election.
So what's on the agenda of the Rassemblement?
The Rassemblement has its own agenda. Starting this August 8th and August 9th, we have 2 days ghost town all over the country. People have to stay at home to tell Mr. Kabila that we totally disagree with him and we want him to leave power. Secondly, on August 20th, we'll have a meeting in the old big town of Congo. Then we'll continue our action. We have given the ultimatum to Mr. Nanga that he has to give us the election date by September 30th. If not, we will call for a civil disobedience and we will tell the people of Congo to not recognize Mr. Kabila, also the international community to do the same, and we will tell people not to pay any taxes until Mr. Kabila will leave power.
Martin Fayulu is a member of the main opposition coalition in the DRC, known as the Rassemblement. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Kenyan civil society groups took to the streets of Nairobi on Tuesday to demand justice in the killing of an election official a week before the country's hotly contested nationwide polls. Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Several dozens protesters marched to the Electoral Commission offices Tuesday in central Nairobi, demanding justice for Chris Msando. The election official was found dead Monday after going missing Friday. According to the head of Kenya's Electoral Commission, Msando was tortured before he was killed. Anti-corruption campaigner John Githongo says Msando's killing was meant to derail the electoral process.
The timing of his torture and murder serves to undermine Kenya's election management body at this most crucial time in the work of the IEBC.
The nationwide vote is 1 week away, and the organization of the elections has been a source of tension during the past year. Msando was to oversee the use of biometric voter technology. Kenya Human Rights Commission Executive Director George Kigoro helped organize the march.
Even as an investigation gets on its way, we remind the state of its duty to take whatever necessary measures it finds possible to secure the safety of the IBC commissioners and all its staff. An intimidated and fearful staff cannot fully deliver on its mandate or respect its oath to act without fear or favor in carrying out the important responsibilities it has been entrusted by the citizens of Kenya.
Political parties on both sides have condemned Musando's killing. The ruling Jubilee coalition issued a statement urging police to investigate, and one of the leaders of the main opposition alliance, Musalia Mudavadi, spoke to reporters.
Chris, on television last week, assured Kenyans that they need not worry about the Kenya Integrated Electronic Management System, as he was sure it would work. That no effort was made to camouflage this killing as an accident shows the determination of the killers to send a chilling message that they will stop at nothing to ensure the outcome they desire.
Electoral Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati met with the protesters and said the commission is determined to do its job.
We lost our dear employee. I lost an employee whom I used to consult every other day. We are mourning with the family, we are mourning with the IPC family, but this country is bigger than all of us. We have a mandate to deliver to the Kenyan people.
Kenya's Inspector General of Police called Musando's killing a crime of grave proportions and said a team has been assembled to follow what he called several crucial leads to bring the murderers to justice. The United States and Britain have offered to assist Kenya in the investigation. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Wednesday, August 2nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A new report on South Sudan has renewed calls for sanctions and an arms embargo on top officials above the government and the rebels in the country's civil war. Human Rights Watch says it has credible evidence of serious human rights violations committed by both sides in South Sudan's nearly four-year-long conflict. IMBO has more from Washington.
President Salva Kiir, former First Vice President Riek Machar, and former Army Chief of Staff Paul Malong are three of the nine men singled out in the report that Human Rights Watch says should face sanctions for their role in the conflict that has devastated the social and economic structure of the country. Jahan Henry, senior researcher in Human Rights Watch's Africa division, says based on their research, the three men and other leaders have been implicated in abusive operations across the country.
We have come to the conclusion now, after almost 4 years of conflict in South Sudan, that there is sort of mounting evidence of the role of key commanders in the ongoing atrocities. There are two components to it. First is overseeing the troops that are committing these atrocities, which gives a certain liability to the top commanders. But the second is failing to then prevent them or stop them.
HRW is also recommending sanctions on Lieutenant General Bola Kut, who oversaw Gudele and Mio Saba during the violence in December 2013, and General Johnson Olong, an opposition commander who allegedly recruited child soldiers in the Upper Nile region. The report names five other generals who have been implicated in abuses during the conflict. HRW has long called for an arms embargo on South Sudan and targeted sanctions against top leaders in the government and opposition forces. To date, six individuals are on the UN sanctions list, which includes a travel ban and asset freeze. HRW is urging that the list be expanded to include top political leaders and generals closely tied to the conflict. This report focuses on civilian testimony from Kajo Keji in the former Central Equatoria State, as well as Pajuk in neighboring Eastern Equatoria State, between June 2016 until this past May. HRW says in both areas, government soldiers committed serious crimes against civilians. The conflict spread to the western parts of the Greater Equatoria region in late 2015 and expanded southeast since then. The rights group says the attacks in Kajo Keji began in mid-2016. The report says witnesses described at least 47 unlawful killings by government soldiers there, although Henry says researchers believe the number is much higher.
We met with refugees living in the settlements in northern Uganda, and they almost all said that they were afraid to return home. And those few who did, for collecting food or for guarding their livestock, reported facing various types of dangers as well.
Under the former U.S. Obama administration, a U.S.-led UN resolution to enact an arms embargo and sanctions on South Sudan failed in December. Russia, China, and six other Security Council members abstained from voting, killing the resolution. In April, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley urged the Security Council to impose an arms embargo and additional sanctions on South Sudan. That has yet to take place. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
Officials representing both the South Sudan government and the rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar are dismissing the findings of a Human Rights Watch report. Wake Simon Wudu has details from Juba.
President Salva Kiir's spokesman Atieni Wek Atieni says the report contains no new information and specifically denies Kiir or his generals bear responsibility for the crimes and abuses documented in the report.
By looking at the nature of the cut and faced reports, one would actually wonder as to what the Human Rights Watch is actually looking for. Is it looking for a solution to the problem, or is trying to aggravate the problem by suggesting things that if they are done, they would even push this country to further in on violence?
The report says government officials deployed to fight rebels in counterinsurgency operations committed a range of crimes against civilians, including arbitrary detention, torture, and enforced disappearances that were based solely on the victim's ethnicity. The report accuses the rebels of committing similar rights abuses. Attorney denies the charges.
There are a number of individuals, you know, violations that may happen. You know, individual may take law into their own hand, but that doesn't mean that the government has a policy of, you know, killing the civilian.
Attorney accuses rebel forces of carrying out the vast majority of atrocities. General Nathaniel Oyet is the SPLAIO-designated governor of Imatong State and denies rebel leader Riek Machar bears any responsibility for the rights violations described in the report.
Our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, is innocent, is a victim of human rights himself. So he cannot be sanctioned together with the perpetrators of human rights. It is Salva Kiir and his government that deserve sanction because they have blocked the peace agreement.
Machar's group insists the 2015 peace agreement has collapsed. Attorney says the government and the SPLAIO Tabandengai faction in the government is implementing the deal.
The government is on unilateral ceasefire. The government is pursuing the path of national dialogue. The government is doing its best to protect the civilians where appropriate. All these things, the government are doing them in an attempt to make the country peaceful.
Fighting continues between government forces and rebels in parts of the country. Just last week, heavy fighting was reported in Maiwut town of Maiwut State between pro-government forces and rebels loyal to Machar. Colonel Dixon Galuak, spokesman for the SPLAIO Tabandengai faction, told the South Sudan in Focus that government troops had full control of the town and that the government intended to dislodge forces loyal to Machar from key towns in the Upper Nile region. Rebel forces have disputed claims that the government is in full control of Maiwut town. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Burundi's government says it will waive taxes for any member of the Burundian diaspora returning home to invest. The move follows President Pierre Nkurunziza's call for Burundian refugees to repatriate and contribute to the development of the country. Moses Aviarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Celebrations. As Burundi Diaspora Week kicks off in Bujumbura for the second time after the first edition that took place in 2014, more than 100 Burundians from the diaspora meet in Bujumbura to celebrate the week that will see participants traveling countrywide to explore the opportunities to invest in the country. Gaston Sindimo, the Burundi First Vice President, called on Burundians in diaspora to invest and contribute in the development activities in the country. He says that Burundi government will waive taxes on Burundians who will be willing to repatriate with their capital and businesses, and that the government will also be willing to avail land to Burundians who will be willing to invest in the development projects in the country. In 2015, more than 400,000 Burundians fled to the neighboring countries when the country plunged into the political turmoil that led to more than 500 people getting killed. According to the representative of Burundians in diaspora, Japhet Ndayishimiye, approximately 6% of the country's population live in diaspora. He says remittance had also played a key role in the country's economy.
Now we have to sit with the government to evaluate, to see how many Burundians are abroad, how much money, what kind of skills they have. Then we can come back to say, this is exactly what we have. We are going to work together. So we need a law to give a possibility Burundians living outside to continue the action of development.
Burundians living in the diaspora are set to share their skills as first-line psychiatrist diagnosis in the entire country will be trained in Burundi. Christina Major, is the chief of mission at International Organization for Migration in Burundi.
We are celebrating the second Diaspora Week. The first was held in 2014. We're celebrating both financially and technically, both the first 2 days in Bujumbura and then also in Muaro in Makamba. And it's really a celebration and honoring of the diaspora and how migration and development can contribute through migration for the benefit of all, for the country of origin, for the country of destination, and for the migrant themselves.
As Burundi is continuing to gain stability after the violent protests that erupted 2 years ago, when the incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for a third term in the office, the government reported more than 1,500 Burundians repatriated since the beginning of this year. However, some opposition leaders still feel insecure to return to the country for fear of being convicted by the Burundian authority. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Senegal's technology scene has been slow to get off the ground for lack of qualified coders, but a locally run company is trying to change that while also helping young people find jobs. Sophia Christensen has the story from Dakar.
Local tech startups are tackling day-to-day conveniences in Dakar. Firefly, a digital advertising company, places TV screens in public buses, but has struggled to find qualified web and mobile app developers in Senegal.
They are trained in technologies we do not work with. For example, all engineering schools in Dakar work in Java. We work mostly with PHP and Python, with new front-end technologies like Bootstrap. These are not things they learn in school.
Until recently, that is. This is Volcano. Students learn web development, digital marketing, or graphic design. At the end of the one-month training program, they will spend 2 months interning with a local company. The classes are free. Volcano is supported by companies like Firefly in exchange for interns. At least 15 of those interns have landed full-time contracts. CEO Abdoulkadre Diallo initially set up Volcano to provide tech services to local entrepreneurs. The training program was launched later when he realized none of his interns were sufficiently qualified.
Here, young people are not encouraged to be interested in these skills. Most schools remain too classical. The training is too classical. You see schools where in 5 years there is no decent practical training, in my opinion.
There are efforts to change that. At this coding workshop in the northern city of Saint-Louis, high school students are introduced to coding and web development. The next Einstein Forum's Africa Science Week is held in 13 African countries to promote interest in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
For me, the problem lies in the content of university courses, because you can start by teaching HTML, but then you evolve and teach HTML5. For me, we must simply update everything.
Volcano has registered over 14 functioning startups in Dakar, all of which operate through websites and mobile applications.
If you are trained in technology, you can find work after you graduate because it is very difficult to find internships and everything here, and your relations play a big role. But for example, if you learn programming, you can set up your own project, create an application. If you know digital marketing, you can do all the promotion yourself, so it is important to get training.
The founder of Senegal's next big startup may be sitting right here in this room. Sophia Christensen, for VOA News, Dakar.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A member of the main opposition in the Democratic Republic of Congo says the group is planning a series of civil disobedience actions this month to force the Election Commission to announce a timetable for elections to be held this year. Martin Fayulu of the main opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, says beginning August 8, the group will call for a stay-at-home protest or ghost towns in all major cities of the country. This comes as security forces this week arrested members of a pro-democracy group known as Lucha. And that's it for this Wednesday, August 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a nice day, Africa.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa?
Then, plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.